The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Pleasure to see so many of you here. I'm delighted to be here in Philadelphia. I on the subject of there being so many of you, I always remember my very, very first event, book event, for my first book, The Tipping Point, was in, we made the mistake of scheduling it in Los Angeles, a city, of course, where people don't read, and four people showed up, and one was my publicist, who was paid to be there, one was a friend of mine from college who came with his then wife. They broke up some weeks later. The fourth person was the mother of a friend of mine. My friend didn't come, but she did send her mother. It was very traumatizing. But so whenever I always have this great fear, of course, that there's only going to be four. So I'm happy to see there's more than four. The fifth person to walk in tonight was the one who really made this evening special for me. The rest of you are just gravy. I'm going to talk for about half an hour, and I say that I wanted to make that clear because, you know, I in my book, for those of you who have read it, I spend a great deal of time talking about cultural differences and how profound they are, how great our expectations are, greatly they're shaped by where we're from. And I some years ago I went to I gave a talk at a conference in Colombia, and I asked the organizers of the conference how long I should talk, and the organizer said, "Oh, I don't know. What do you think? Maybe 2.5 hours?" And, of course, I said, "Oh, dear." And he said, "You know, in Colombia, if you talk for less than 2 hours, the audience feels cheated." So I didn't know what the rules were in Philadelphia, which I know to be culturally distinct from New York City. But maybe half an hour will be enough. I want to talk about something, an idea that's not actually technically in the book. You know, all the best ideas you have come after the book is done. That's the sad thing about books. But it's a lovely idea that has helped me kind of conceptualize a lot of what I was thinking about when I wrote this book. And it's an idea that was that comes from a wonderful psychologist named James Flynn, who's one of my heroes. And it's the idea is called capitalization. And what it refers to is the efficiency of a group, a society, or a community at making use of the human potential in its midst. And Flynn refers to the capitalization rate as the percentage of people who are capable of doing something, achieving something, who actually achieve that thing, right? He calls that the cap rate, the capitalization rate. And I thought of capitalization rate, for example, when I was reading, I don't know how many of you read Michael Lewis's book, The Blind Side, which I consider to be one of the great books of the last decade. And it's a story, as those of you who have read it know, about a young man named Michael Oher, who is a 6'6", 350-pound boy. He's at the time the book opens. He's just a young teenager who lives in the slums of East Memphis. And he is discovered walking along the side of the street. He's spotted by a wealthy white family from the suburbs who adopt him. And the story of the book is about the coming of age of this young man. And it's also secondarily about Michael Oher's coming of age as an athlete, because he turns out to be this extraordinary football player. And he ends up being one of the most highly recruited high school football players in all the land. And there's a moment at the end of the book where he says something that I found extraordinary. And he says, you know, he's talking about his neighbor growing up in East Memphis. He says, you know, if all the kids I grew up with who could have played football, you'd need two national football leagues. And what he was saying was that the capitalization rate for football players in East Memphis is actually really low. And so Lewis does this thing where he calls up the local school board in East Memphis, and he asks them this really simple question. He says, you know, do you guys keep track of how many athletic scholarships are offered to kids in your school district in East Memphis? And they can say yes. And he says, well, what percentage of kids who are offered an athletic scholarship in East Memphis actually end up taking it, actually end up going to college? And the guy says, at the school board says, 1 in 6. Right? Now, when I read that, my jaw dropped. Because I thought that the capitalization rate for professional football in inner city America would be really, really high, right? There's almost nothing as a country we care about more than football. Football is number one on our list of priorities. We spend an enormous amount of time and attention and money and expertise and what have you trying to find talented football players and do everything in our power to make sure those football players get a shot at playing in the NFL, right? We've got a incredibly sophisticated system in place. The meritocracy of meritocracies designed to find and exploit athletic ability in this area. And yet what happens? Our capitalization rate for finding football talent, at least in a place like East Memphis, is 1 in 6. That's 16%. I would have thought it was 90%. Now, what does that tell us? Well, it tells us that if the cap rate for something that we care very deeply about, like football, is 1 in 6, what is the capitalization rate for things we don't care about at all? And that question is really about what my book's about. My book is about what are the kinds of things that stand in the way of human capitalization? What are the kinds of forces, factors, things that constrain capitalization? And what can we do to remove them? If you keep that idea in mind as you read my book, I think it will help put a lot of the arguments in perspective. So what I thought I'd do this evening is I just want to walk through a couple of things that I think constrain capitalization. And much of what I'm about to say is drawn from the book, but some of it is not. It's just stuff that I've been thinking about since. You know, the most obvious thing that constrains capitalization is poverty, right? When Michael Oher says that if all the kids he grew up with who could play football played football, they'd need 2 football leagues. What he's talking about is the effect of poverty. The reason kids from East Memphis don't end up doing what they have the talent to do is that they're in East Memphis, a place where kids are living in abject poverty, where the schools are terrible, where nobody's got a job, where drug use and crime are rampant, where I could go on and on and on. And all of those things are things that stand in the way of people making the best use of their potential. Now, we know that, right? That's not a surprise to anyone in this room. And when we take steps to alleviate poverty, that's part of the reason why. Because we want to increase capitalization. When we go to one of the reasons people have gotten so interested in attacking poverty in Africa is that we understand that in the poorest parts of Africa, there is an incredible waste of human talent. How many potentially brilliant scientists are there living in sub-equatorial Africa who we never find, who never get a chance to even go to school and discover they have that kind of ability, right? That idea motivates us in a lot of our social policy. But one of the things I think is true is that even though we understand how much poverty constrains capitalization, we underestimate its effect. And I tell a story in a book that I think makes this point. It's a story about one of the most famous psychological tests of all time, and it was a test conducted by famous Stanford University psychologist Lewis Terman in the 1920s. And what Terman does is he gives an IQ test to 250,000, a quarter of a million elementary school children in the state of California in the 20s. And he identifies the 1,500 who had the absolute highest IQ scores. So we're talking about kids, 7, 8, 9, 10-year-olds, who have IQs in excess of 140 or 150. These are genius-level IQs. These are kids who, if you met them, you would be absolutely stunned by their intellectual precocity. And what Terman does is he identifies these kids and he sets out to follow them, to study them for the rest of their lives. And his notion is that kind of extraordinary intelligence is so critical to succeeding in the modern world that what he's done by identifying this group of kids at the age of 8 and 9 and 10 is to identify the future academic, political, business, social leaders of the state of California and the country that we live in, right? He's convinced of this. He really thinks that he has identified the future elite. So he follows them for decades, along the way amassing enormous dossiers on every aspect of their lives, with this thought in mind that he's really kind of mapping the future of the country's elite. And after about 25 or 30 years, he looks at where the kids he was following are called termites, in honor of the psychologist Lewis Terman. He has to concede that he's in error. He hasn't identified the future elite of the United States. Some of them, a small group, about the top 15%, really do have exceptional lives. They're top academics, they're successful businessmen, they're judges, they're people who society would call winners. But there's a big group in the middle who have careers that are pretty ordinary. And most distressing of all is that there's a sizable group at the bottom who have careers that by any definition would be called unsuccessful, failures. These are people who haven't graduated from college, who didn't go to college, who didn't graduate from high school, who have menial jobs, who don't have jobs at all, who by any stretch of the imagination have squandered their extraordinary gifts, have not made use of this one in a million mind that God blessed them with. And so Terman sets out to answer, how did this happen? What is it that separated the 15% who did so well from this distressing group at the bottom who don't seem to have done well at all? And he goes down the list. He goes through all of his dossier, looking at every conceivable data point that he's gathered over all those 30 years. And he looks at their, is it their psychological makeup? Is it their interests, their hobbies? Is it their how attractive they are? I mean, he looks at everything, and he can't find anything to explain it until he comes to the obvious one, the social class. The kids from the wealthy families, the families where learning is valued, where books are cherished, those kids go on to make the best use of their extraordinary intelligence. The children who come from the other side of the tracks, who grew up in homes where the parents didn't value education, where books weren't around, where learning wasn't something that was cherished, those kids, almost without exception, did not make it, in the conventional sense of the word, as adults in the occupational world. Right? Now, that's an astonishing fact, because remember, we're not talking about ordinary children here. We're talking about children who are blessed with minds that are one in a million, genius-level IQs. If you met them when they were 6 or 7 or 8 years old, you would be stunned at what they knew and what they could do. And you would say, I can't believe that anything would ever stand in the way of this child making the best use of his or her intellect. But something did stand in the way of that child capitalizing on their intelligence, and that's poverty. Poverty trumps genius. Even the most extraordinary mind is not powerful enough to overcome the incredible obstacles that poverty put in the way of making use of your abilities. And that, I think, is something that even if we concede that poverty is the biggest constraint on capitalization, we wouldn't have thought it would constrain the career, the success of a genius, but it does. So that's the first thing to keep in mind, to wonder, when we look at the world around us, do we underestimate just what a hurdle poverty is when we look at people's ability to make the best use of their lives? So that's the first constraint on capitalization. Another one, a second one I look at, comes from, I spend a lot of time in the book looking at the rosters of elite sports teams, because I'm really interested in that. And you can learn all kinds of really cool things when you look at elite sports teams. Because sports, of course, as I've said before, is a meritocracy, or at least we think of it as a meritocracy. So you can learn a lot about meritocracies and how they work by looking at who makes it as a professional athlete. So what I thought I'd do is I picked one sports team, elite sports team at random. And when I say random, I mean I actually did do this at random. And what I thought I would do is I would just read to you the birthdays of every member of this team. And the team I picked was the 2007 Czech Republic National Junior Men's Hockey Team. And I really did pick it at random. I could have, of course, used a Canadian hockey team. I'm Canadian. But I thought that would be a conflict of interest. So I chose the next best thing, which was a Czech team. And by the way, this is a very, very good team. The Czech team, I think, finished second at the 2007 World Championship. So it's not a bad team at all. They were beaten only, of course, by the Canadians. So here goes. I'm going to read to you, and I want you to see, can you discern a pattern? Just listen. I'm going to read to you their birthdays. January 3rd, January 3rd, January 12th, February 8th, February 10th, February 17th, February 20th, February 24th, March 5th, March 10th, March 26th, April 22nd, May 5th, June 6th, July 2nd, July 19th, July 20th, August 15th, August 25th, August 31st, November 29th, December 31st. Okay. See the pattern? Here we have the roster of one of the best junior hockey teams in the world. Two kids out of 20 were born in the last 4 months of the year. Right? More importantly, 11 out of the 20 were born in January, February, and March. We have a profoundly uneven distribution of birth dates on this team. Now, is that something that is specific to the 2007 men's junior Czech Republic national hockey team? No. It is something that is true of absolutely every hockey team that you can think of. Hockey skews, the elite rosters of hockey teams are populated overwhelmingly with kids born in January, February, and March. Now, why is that? It's because International Hockey, the International Hockey Federation, has set as its eligibility cutoff for age class hockey January 1st. And in places like Czechoslovakia and hockey and Canada, where hockey is taken very, very seriously, people start recruiting the best athletes, the most talented athletes, for all-star squads at the age of 9 and 10, right? They look at a whole bunch of 9 and 10-year-olds playing hockey, and they say, those three are the best ones, and they pull them out, and they put them on a traveling squad, and they give them extra coaches and extra, all kinds of encouragement, and they play extra games, and they get way more practice time, and then that's the kind of stream of kids that are used to select the national junior team and the national senior team. But think about it. If you observe a group of 9-year-olds playing hockey, who is likely to be the most talented? Well, the oldest kids, right? Obviously. When you're 9, if you're born in January, you could be 15, 20 pounds heavier and 6 inches taller than a kid born in December. 12 months of maturity at that age is an enormous advantage. So we think we're choosing the most talented. We're not. We're choosing the oldest. And then we give them specialized attention, and we tell them they're the best, and we give them extra coaching, and we put them on the all-star team, and lo and behold, 8 and 9 years later, they really are the best. But it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? We create that meritocracy that we thought we were creating was in fact weighted heavily, biased according to the rules that we used to choose the people who would get that special privilege. Now you only have to look at that and to realize how profoundly that kind of system constrains capitalization, right? Logic tells us there should be as many great hockey players born in the second half of the year as there are born in the first half of the year. But we can't find any players born in the second half of the year on the squads of these elite teams. So what's the capitalization rate for hockey in Czechoslovakia? If it's 50%, I'd be stunned, right? It's at least somewhere south of 50%. And what's the solution to that? Is there a way they could raise their capitalization rate? Well, of course there is. All they have to do is to go back to age class hockey and rearrange it. Have 3 parallel leagues. One league for kids born in the first 4 months of the year, one league for kids born in the second 4 months, and one league for kids born in the last 4 months. And let all of those kids play with other kids their same age. And when they're all old enough, then make your decision about who's talented and who's not. Well, why don't we do that? Why don't we adjust for this really obvious, glaring problem that has the effect of profoundly constraining capitalization rates? Right? Why don't we do it? Because we're stupid. Right? And that is the second constraint on capitalization. It's the stupidity constraint. Right? Now, you may say, what do we care about hockey? Hockey is something, I realize you take your hockey very seriously and Philadelphia, but the Philadelphia Flyers, like most hockey teams in the NHL, are primarily filled with Czechs and Canadians. So you might say, why do we care? That doesn't affect us here in the United States. All right. Well, I'm going to read to you the roster of another team taken at random. Only this is not a hockey team, but this is a soccer team. And the team I've chosen at random is the 2007 Czech Republic National Junior Men's Soccer Team. Also a very, very good soccer team. Ready? I'm going to read you the birth dates of the kids on this team, and I want you to see if you can spot a pattern. September 26th, August 18th, June 24th, June 22nd, May 26th, May 20th, April 16th, March 29th, March 26th, March 15th, February 24th, February 21st, February 20th, February 14th, February 1st, January 27th, January 26th, January 12th, January 5th, January 3rd, January 1st. See the pattern? Right? Same pattern. Why is that? Because the International Soccer Federation has as its cutoff date for age class eligibility January 1st. Another stupidity constraint, right? What do you do if you're a very gifted athlete living in Czechoslovakia and you want to play the two great sports of Czechoslovakia, hockey and soccer, and you happen to be born on December 31st? You give up, right? The world has created a so-called meritocracy that has no room for you. And why is it done that? Because it's stupid. Now, you might say, I don't care about soccer either. Why does that have any? Well, think about it. This exact same phenomenon clearly applies to schooling as well. We do the same thing in schools. We have kids. We make decisions about which kids are academically gifted and which kids are not. When do we do those decisions? Very early on. When kids are very young, when this same kind of difference in physical maturity clearly would make an impact on their intellectual maturity. And sure enough, if you do, when psychologists do analysis of school performance broken down by date of birth, by month of birth, what they find is that kids in the relatively oldest cohort in their school class, in elementary school, in their school year, outperform kids in the relatively youngest cohort on science and math tests by between 4 and 11 percentile points. That's huge, right? Has nothing to do with their real level of academic ability. It just has to do with how close they are to the cutoff date. And you say, well, that's elementary school kids. Maybe it doesn't matter so much. Well, when two economists recently looked at an enormous database of kids throughout the Western world, what they found is that those differences in performance by month of birth persist even into college years, and that kids born in the relatively youngest cohort of their school year are 11% less likely to go to college than kids born in the relatively oldest section of their school year. That is a massive constraint on capitalization, right? We are standing in the way of the ability of kids to make the most of their potential, because you have to go to college these days to make the most of your potential in almost any field, right? We've placed a constraint on the ability of not just thousands or hundreds of thousands, but millions of kids around the developed world. We've placed a constraint on their ability to make the most of their talent. Why? Because we're stupid. Because we have failed to create a really fair system. And we fail to take into account the extent to which our own rules, our own arbitrary rules, can have the effect of thwarting the ability of a certain section of the population to make the most of their talents. So that's the second constraint on capitalization. And I think it's a profound one, right? Poverty stands in the way of people making the best use of their abilities, and so does stupidity. Third constraint, and in many ways this is the to my mind, the most important of the three. And it's the constraint of attitude. I spent a lot of time in this book, in Outliers, on the question of math. And in particular, I'm very interested in, one of the questions I'm interested in is, why is it that Asian school children so dramatically outperform their Western counterparts at advanced algebra and calculus? You know, we do these international comparisons, and what we find is that teenagers from South Korea, Japan, Singapore, Taiwan, Hong Kong outperform their counterparts in the West in advanced math in high school by, you know, it's not this, it's this. It's a huge amount. It's such a huge difference, in fact, that it commands explanation. You can't shrug it off, right? So the question is why? Every time we do these tests, we find the same thing over and over again. Is it because in those countries they spend more money on education than we do? No. They probably spend less money. Is it because they have really small classrooms that allow for intimate relationships between teachers, math teachers and their students, right? No. They have bigger classrooms. Do they have incredible curriculum that has the effect of rendering the most oblique and difficult of advanced math concepts utterly transparent to the teenage eye? Right? No. They're using the same math textbooks we are, only they're translated into a different language. What's the difference? Well, we think it's attitude. When we talk to teenagers from those kinds of Asian countries, and we ask them a very simple question, which is, what do you think it takes to be good at math? They overwhelmingly answer, I think that you can get the right answer on a math problem if you work hard. Right? Think that math is something that yields its secrets to effort. That's the overwhelming attitude of kids from those countries. When we ask kids from the developed world, American kids, English kids, German kids, the same question, they overwhelmingly answer that I think that people who get the right answer in math get the right answer because they're good at math. They got a gene for math. They got a math head. They're one of those people who just aren't good at it. They use an effort attribution. We use an ability attribution. And as it happens, the Asian kids are right. Math is a subject that yields its secrets to effort. It is not a subject that requires some kind of special genetic propensity. Our view is nonsense. Their view is correct. If you don't believe me, there's a wonderful illustration of this. Every 4 years, one of the tests that we use to figure out how good various countries are at math is called TIMSS. And it's this test, International Math Comparison Test, that's given to kids around the world every 4 years. And along with the math test at TIMSS, the psychologists who dream up and run TIMSS also have a questionnaire. And it's ask kids all kinds of questions like, what do your parents do for a living? How many hours do you study? That kind of stuff. And the questionnaire, because it's designed by psychologists, is really long. And it's 120 questions long. And it's so long, in fact, that most kids don't finish it, right? It's just too much. It's like they get overwhelmed. So a couple years ago, this very clever psychologist, actually here at Penn, a man named Erling Bo. He's not in the audience, is he? I always like to check. He did this really, really cool thing, which was he decided to rank the countries of the world according to what percentage of questions on the questionnaire their kids answered, right? And then he compared that ranking to the ranking of the countries of the world according to what percentage of questions on the math test their kids got right. And you know what he found? Two rankings, exactly the same, right? Same, no difference. What does that tell you? It says if you want to rank the countries of the world in terms of their math ability, you don't have to ask them any math tests. Okay? And no math questions whatsoever. You just have to give them any kind of task that measures their ability to work hard. Anything that would measure their ability to focus and sit down and finish some kind of long, onerous task is going to correlate beautifully with that culture's ability at math. That's what math is. It is something that yields its secrets to effort. And the Asian countries have understood that attitude, and we have not. And what has that allowed them to do? That has allowed them to capitalize on their math ability in a way that we haven't. They're not inherently smarter than us. They don't have more math talent than us. They don't have a gene that we don't have that somehow translates beautifully to solving differential equations. No, they work harder than us because they believe that working hard when it comes to math pays off. Now, one of the things I do in the book is, it's a really fun moment in the book, is I try and figure out, okay, if that's their attitude that they have and we don't, why do they have that attitude? Where does it come from? Right? Attitudes come from somewhere. And I should say, if you do buy the book and read it, when you come to that section, nobody knows. There is no right or wrong answer to this, right? We don't have a good explanation, so everyone's got their own pet theory. Well, James Flynn, the guy who I mentioned at the beginning, he was the first to kind of suggest, look, I think it has something to do with the cultural habits laid down by agricultural practices. And he points out that the thing that South Korea and Japan and Hong Kong to some extent Singapore have in common is that they're wet rice growing countries. They're countries that were whose dominant form of agriculture historically has been the cultivation of wet rice. And what do we know about rice cultivation? It's the most labor intensive form of agriculture in the world, right? You know, my ancestors on my father's side were peasants in Europe in the medieval period, as I suspect many of the ancestors of the people in this room were. And so our ancestors, if indeed you share my European background, our ancestors, we think they worked about 1,000 hours a year. So they woke up at about dawn, and they worked in the wheat fields until about noon, and then they drank lots and lots of beer, and they slept it off. And they repeated, right? That was Monday to Friday, and then they got the weekends off, and they got lots and lots of religious holidays. This is something we've forgotten about the medieval era, but they had tons and tons of holidays. Our ancestors in Europe had really, really appalling, miserable lives, but they did not work hard, right? Let's be absolutely clear on that point. In the winter, they just drank beer and slept. Okay, so the equivalent medieval farmer living in South China or Japan in the Middle Ages did not work 1,000 hours a year. He or she worked 3,000 hours a year. They woke up at dawn, and they didn't stop work at noon. They worked until dusk. And they didn't take the weekend off. They worked through the weekend. They didn't have lots and lots and lots of holidays, right? They worked through those holidays. And they didn't sleep and drink their way through winter. They planted a second rice crop in the winter. We think that those rice farmers worked 3,000 hours a year, three times harder than their European counterparts. There's a wonderful series of proverbs that capture this difference in attitudes towards work. And my favorite one is a Chinese proverb. He who rises at dawn and works until dusk 360 days of the year will never go hungry. Now, the equivalent proverb for my ancestors in Europe would have been, he who rises at dawn and works until noon 175 days of the year may or may not go hungry. That's a profound, profound difference. And I make the argument, which I don't think is implausible, that if you have that kind of attitude towards effort in your culture for 1,000 years, it doesn't go away just because you're no longer working in the rice paddies. Right? Those kinds of cultural practices persist. And as it happens, that's a beautiful attitude to bring to the math classroom. Right? That is precisely the right attitude to have when you sit down and try and do calculus or algebra for the first time as a 16 or 17-year-old. And that, I think, makes a profound difference in the ability of their society and ours to capitalize on something like mathematics. It has, like I said, it has nothing to do with anything inherent. It has nothing to do with genes or and it has nothing to do with how much money they spend or how large their classrooms are or what have you. It has to do with attitudes. And attitudes are an overwhelmingly important factor in explaining any kind of capitalization. So why, I won't go much further, why is it so important to think about this question of capitalization? I think that we have a tendency, an unfortunate but kind of natural tendency, whenever we observe differences in outcomes, whenever we see that one group does really well and another group doesn't, or one person does really well and another person doesn't, we have an unfortunate tendency to interpret that difference in terms of innate ability. Right? We see that one group is succeeding wildly, another is suffering, and we say the group that is succeeding wildly, they must have some kind of inherent advantage. And that is an unfortunate heuristic we use to make sense of the world. And I say unfortunate because I think in most cases that interpretation is faulty. That there is a much more convincing and plausible and elegant and simple explanation for differences in outcome. And it's not talent, it's capitalization. It's simply that some groups are better equipped to capitalize on the relatively stable pool of human ability that is available to them, and some groups do a lousy job of capitalization. I thought of this. You know, I'm a runner, and like all distance runners, I have been over the years utterly fascinated by the extraordinary dominance of East Africans in distance running. If you look at the top 25 times in the 10,000 meters every year, you will see that 23 of the 25 are runners from Kenya or Ethiopia, right? And it's very easy as a runner to look at that and say, well, those runners from Kenya and Ethiopia must have some inherent advantage over the rest of us. They must be equipped with some gene that makes them able to run further and faster. And it is, you know, every single article that talks about the dominance of East Africans in distance running ends up with that conclusion somehow. There's something in their genes that explains it. They're just built different from the rest of us. And what we forget is that there is a far less provocative and problematic explanation available, and that's capitalization. You know, Alberto Salazar, the great American marathoner, recently came back from Kenya and pointed out that in Kenya, a country of, I think, no more than about 30 million people, there are, he estimated, 1 million teenage boys who run at least 12 miles a day. A million, right? What's the equivalent figure for the United States, a country I would point out 10 times larger than Kenya? If there are 5,000 teenagers in this country who run 12 miles a day, I would be stunned, right? So what's our capitalization rate when it comes to distance running? 1%? 2%? What's the Kenyan capitalization rate when it comes to distance running? I don't know, 95%? Do you think they're missing any distance runners in Kenya, right? I think there's some really brilliant distance runner out there in Kenya who somehow hasn't been discovered because it hasn't occurred to anyone to see whether he's capable of running. No, they don't miss anybody. Well, that explains why they're so dominant in distance running. They've raised their capitalization rate as high as it can go. And we haven't. Now, I'm not saying we should, but I'm just saying we don't have to do this go immediately to this talent explanation when there is a far more useful and a far less loaded explanation available, and that is that these differences reflect differences in capitalization. Now, there's a second reason, and a more important reason, to think about these problems in terms of capitalization, and that is if you think about differences in outcome in terms of inherent differences in ability, that's a very pessimistic conclusion. What can you do about a difference that's the result of a gene that someone has and a gene that someone else doesn't? Nothing, right? Nothing. But what can you do about a problem that lies in a difference in capitalization? A lot, right? You can remove the problem of poverty. You can remove the constraint of stupidity. You can change the constraint of attitude. Poverty and stupidity and attitudes are things we can do something about. And to think about differences in human outcomes in terms of capitalization, I think, is to give us the most profoundly optimistic message of all. Thanks so much. Thank you. We're now going to do questions. I feel compelled to share this hilarious thing that happened to me when I was on my book tour in Amsterdam, and the Dutch, as those of you who are Dutch would know, are pride themselves on their bluntness. And so the moderator of this talk I was giving, when it came down to Q&A, he said, and I'm not going to try and do a Dutch accent, but he said, you know, we at the Jurgen whatever Institute have a very simple rule. We have a little device we use to blow up people who ask long questions. And then he said, a question should be three sentences. Sentence number one is, you know, Mr. Author, I love your work very much. Sentence number two is the topic that you're addressing. Sentence number three is the question. I thought that was so charming. And all the Dutch just loved it. And they all said, as part of their question, Mr. Blabble, I like your work very much. And it was such a wonderful experience. No, I'm not suggesting you should do that here in Philadelphia. But so fire away. I think you have to wait for the microphone.
Where does morality fit in this puzzle? Pointing to the capitalization of human power in the Wall Street area of New York City.
Yeah. Where does morality... Well, morality fits in... there is a... I mean, when we think about the talent versus capitalization explanations of differences in... by the way, I'm not going to answer the Wall Street part of the question. But I will answer the morality. It's a really good question. I have for some time been increasingly distressed by our obsession as a society with genetic explanations for things. That is not because I don't think genes play a role. They do. It is that I think there is a kind of covert agenda behind thinking about problems in terms of inherent differences. And the covert agenda is that it is an argument for doing nothing. It's an argument for inaction. It's a way of saying we are profoundly limited as a society in the kinds of differences that we can make in human outcomes. Right? It's a version, a scientific, secular version of the poor will always be with us, right? And I find that morally repugnant. And I also why endlessly go on and on about something that you can't do anything about? Why not spend your time and attention and energy talking about things that you can do something about? So even if, you know, in some cases only 30% of the problem is available through addressing constraints on capitalization, that's fine. 30% is a lot. Let's spend all of our time talking about the 30% that we can do something about. And that, to me, is a far more morally satisfying way to think about how to help people. Right here in the red sweater.
Following up on that, about 4 or 5 years ago, a mentor of mine gave me a photocopy of The Talent Myth, an essay from The New Yorker. So you probably know exactly when it was. I think mm-hmm. it's around 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah.
And it had a big impression on me because at the time, the corporation we were working in was talking very much about how we attracted and retained the top talent. And my mentor and I suspected that that wasn't true. And we had even been to fairly cheesy training seminars that talked about if you're conducting a meeting and there's somebody who's always quiet, you might want to encourage them to speak up. So my question to you is, what can I do as a low to mid-level ranking person in a huge corporation mm-hmm. to do my part to capitalize on people yeah. who don't feel fulfilled or aren't contributing?
Yeah. That's another good question. You know, one of the things that one of the implications of capitalization over talent is that capitalization requires that you suspend judgment about people, right? If you have a talent explanation of success, part of what that means is you want to make a fairly immediate judgment about who is talented or not. You believe that talent is something that's there. All you have to do is expose it, measure it, and you've made your decision. Capitalization is something that understanding the constraints on capitalization and removing them is something that takes time, and it requires patience in an organization. And I think many organizations have gravitated towards talent explanations because they're not willing to be patient anymore. I recently did a piece for The New Yorker talked a lot about teachers, what it means to find good teachers. And this was really the issue at the heart of this, that I was saying that our current approach right now in the teaching profession to improve the quality of teachers is to raise the bar for entry into the profession, to require that people who want to be teachers have higher and higher grades and better test scores and go to fancier and fancier schools. I think that's an error. It's wrong. Because there isn't a great correlation between how high your IQ is and how good a teacher you are. Being a teacher is a complex mixture of a zillion different things, only a small part of which are your ability to be you know, your measure, your the amount of analytic intelligence you have, a lot of it has to do with really so-called soft skills. You know, your ability to be patient with kids, your ability, I mean, I could go on and on and on. Things that are not obvious in someone unless they've actually taught, and things that can be trained, right? But things that if you put someone in an environment where they have a chance to learn from expert teachers, they could learn some of those abilities. But that requires that we do all kinds of things that we are loath to do in the school system or anywhere else. And that is to allow lots of people to try out, to have patience with them as they develop, and to suspend our judgments for some period of time. But that's the approach I think we should take. Over there in the... I'm not wearing my glasses, so you all look fuzzy to me, but...
Firstly, Mr. Gladwell, I greatly enjoy your books.
Finally. You must be Dutch.
Not Dutch. As a second statement of fact, as the parent of a fifth grader who is the youngest boy in his class, besides giving the administration of the school your book, what are the practical ideas that one can impart upon the administration of a school or the teachers in the classroom about the relative disadvantage of those kids?
Good question. In a perfect world, we would do the same thing in elementary school that I proposed doing in hockey and soccer leagues, which is we should have, if you have an elementary school with three classes in each grade, the classes should be divided up by month of birth. That's the obvious thing to do. We seem reluctant to do that for reasons that I don't understand. The second answer is that I very much, without drawing all kinds of conclusions about you, I very much doubt that it's not your child we're worried about. I don't mean that in a personal way. I'm being in a global way. But this is actually a very serious thing. What's happening increasingly now is that constraints of poverty and constraints of poverty and stupidity are combining. And what's happening is that it is kids from very disadvantaged backgrounds who are also born at the end of their school year who are in the biggest trouble. So, and as a lot of middle and upper middle class parents are holding their later born kids back a year, the only ones left in the youngest cohort are these very, very, or the ones at most at risk are the very, very young kids from the poorest possible backgrounds. And they now have a double whammy facing them. And so so I suspect that you're not in that socioeconomic category. So your child has at least that constraint removed from him or her. But for people who don't, you know, what we're doing is we are increasingly isolating and disadvantaging this group of kids with two strikes against them, and that's a very, very troublesome outcome. Over there in the... Yes.
Thank you. I also enjoy your books and your speaking. You implied that these capital constraints may be on the supply side, not enough rising up. But the challenge here is, what if the constraint is really on the demand side? Mm-hmm. For example, you know, National Football League teams are determined by the number of cities that can support the franchise with advertising and fans. And brain surgeons, you know, and they need an operating table. If we double the number of brain surgeons, they're stuck there. Have you dealt with that? What if so? Everybody can't rise up. What goes wrong there?
Really good question. A couple of answers. Remember, so with football, we're not going to double the number of NFL teams. So what is the point of raising capitalization? Well, we would improve the quality of play, wouldn't we, right? If we increase the number... Now, you might say, I'm using football as an analogy. I actually don't care particularly if the quality of play in the NFL goes up or down. But in general, though, when we improve capitalization, in the absence of increasing the number of slots available for those capitalized, what we do is we improve the quality. By increasing the number of people who are competing for those spots, we presumably improve the quality. In general, though, I don't worry so much about... If I thought as a society we had a profound surplus of people who were proficient at advanced mathematics, for example, I would share your concern. I don't think we do. I think our problem is the opposite. You know, until 3 months ago, many companies in this country, you know, would say that they were desperate for skilled people, more skilled people. I was in the Cincinnati airport the other day, and I saw a huge, as a Canadian, this broke my heart, a huge poster on the wall, which was an advertisement for, it was an attempt, it was an advertisement aimed at American doctors saying, give up on America, move to Canada, we need you, right? You know, in Canada, we're short of doctors. We need them. We don't have enough. We can't produce enough, right? We're looking for them. We're trying to find them, but there aren't enough qualified kids coming out of... things have gotten so bad, we've gone to Cincinnati to find our doctors. I always wondered about, do they do that? You know, when you think about that, do they have those in every airport, or did they think, which American city would have doctors most upset with where they live and so, you know, want to go north to... By the way, you know, it's a side issue. I don't mean to put down Cincinnati, which is a lovely place, but that somehow in the Canadian hierarchy there was a judgment made that Canada was better on average than Cincinnati. But back to your very serious point. I don't know. I think we could, in the history of human modern economy over the last couple hundred years is that we have, every time we have raised the general level of literacy and proficiency, we have, all of us have benefited in the end. Maybe in the short term, there might be some constraints if we produce too many of X and there aren't enough spots for people in that profession. But in general, I don't think we would. I think that our society, we suffer far more from too many people without skills than we suffer from too many with skills. Right, and wait for the, otherwise the people in the...
I, too, enjoy your books. which of the policies being discussed by the Obama administration and the Congress are most likely to increase the capitalization of talent in the country?
Which of those three?
No, which of the policies? No,
as
we think about the economic stimulus package, which of the policies being discussed right now
are
most likely to have a powerful effect along the lines you mentioned?
I don't know the answer to that question, to be honest, partly because I don't know... like most of you, I can't make any sense of what. All I know is that an enormous large amount of money is being thrown at an enormous large number of things, and I don't know what those things are yet. I suspect that if some of that money, the money that goes to, say, education will have a greater impact than the money that goes to, say, Citibank. I say that as someone with an account at Citibank, but I don't know yet. And that it actually is a, you know, it's a very, very important question because it goes to this issue of there are a finite number of things that you can do with your money. And at some point, we need to be fairly rigorous in deciding how we prioritize those things, right, and how we measure. Because ultimately what we do want to do is to increase capitalization. We want to increase human beings' ability to make the most out of their lives. What's the best way to do that? And I don't know whether we've been so, this whole crisis has happened so quickly. I don't think we've had time to breathe and to sit down and to say, this is the kind of, these are the things that we think will have the greatest bang for the buck. It's just happened. I mean, it's come. I mean, I don't think there's ever been a crisis that has sort of emerged so quickly and demanded such an immediate response. And that may be one of the, I was reminded, years ago, I wrote a piece about Cesar Millan, you know, the dog whisperer. And in the course of writing this piece, I hung out with all these people who were involved in dance because I wanted to understand how Cesar moved, right? Because he moved very beautifully. Anyway, long story. So I got on the email list of a bunch of dance organizations, and there was one really interesting email the other day in which someone pointed out that during the New Deal, as part of the New Deal, there was a section of the WPA, there was a federal bureaucracy set up to aid dance, right? Which I thought was beautiful. I mean, actually, it all fell apart because there was all this sort of bickering among dancers. But there's something beautiful there, and I don't think that's a joke. I think it's actually kind of there's some kind of, I like the thinking behind that, right? That arts are something that is, it's easy to overlook the extent to which that is important to the fulfillment of all numbers, many kinds of human needs. And it's not clear at all to me that that is a lesser human need than the need that is supplied by some of the more kind of concrete measures that we're considering. So anyway, it's a good question. In the front row in the gray.
I want to go back to the article you wrote about NFL recruiting and teachers. And you talk about something in there, the fact that good teachers have this with-itness quality. Mm-hmm. And I want to know what the difference is. It sounds really like a talent, an innate talent or a genetic difference. So can you explain the difference between this magic called with-itness and then ingrained talent and the fact that I think you said before, you can teach somebody to be a great teacher. Can you teach somebody with itness?
Yeah. So this question is in reference to an article I wrote for The New Yorker a couple months ago, which is about teachers that I mentioned before. And I was talking about this fact that the list of things that make a good teacher good is really long and has relatively little to do with whether they're analytically smart and lots to do with all these other things. And one of the things I talked about was this thing that educational researchers call with-itness, which is the ability to have eyes in the back of your head, right? The great teachers, one of the reasons great teachers can keep their classroom civilized, keep kids from acting up, is that they can monitor kids really expertly. And they point out this whole thing about how there are, in classrooms, there are what's called contagion chains of misbehavior. And so Susie does something to Billy, and Billy does something as a result to Mary, and Mary does something as a result to Jimmy. And as a teacher, if you react when it hits Jimmy, it's too late, right? It's gone. The virus has spread. You got to get Susie. You got to see Susie and nip Susie in the bud. And if you can do that, then your classroom will be under control. And some people can do that, and some people can't. And the question is, the questioner asks is, well, isn't that an example of an innate trait? It might be, and it might not be. If it is, it doesn't kind of scare me if it is, because obviously in any kind of profession, competence is going to be some mixture of things that we have innately, that we're innately blessed with, and things that we learn. And if it happens that you kind of have to have an innate with-itness to be a good teacher, fine. But it's only, remember, one of many, many competencies that a teacher needs. And let's find the people with wisdomness and then figure out what they need to learn and teach them that. That's a totally acceptable. But we always know there's going to be a combination. What's not acceptable is just to blandly assume that everything, that someone is equipped natively with everything they need and that there isn't, you know, work to be done to help them remove barriers to their competence. How about way back in the back on the row with black hair? That's it.
You mentioned attitude as sort of the third part of your earlier discussion. If you could talk to the difficulty of changing attitudes and also what you think are the most effective means of doing that.
Yeah. So this is a big theme in the book, is in making two what appear to be contradictory, but I don't think they are arguments. One, that I argue that attitudes have deep roots, cultural attitudes have deep roots. So the rice paddy discussion is an example of that, but I have a couple of examples. I think that who we are is powerfully shaped by where we're from. And when I say where we're from, I mean not 100 years ago necessarily, but sometimes 200 or 300 or 400, right? Simultaneously, though, I believe that as human beings, we are capable, if we take concerted and direct action, and if we are willing to talk honestly about culture, we are capable of changing it. And I tell a number of stories in the book about how that is possible. One of them in the context of education, I have a chapter about the KIPP academies. And I guess you had them in Philadelphia, right? And how I think those are beautiful examples of how they are importing a set of cultural attitudes into classrooms in inner city areas, right? They're taking an Asian attitude about learning, and they have shown that kids in the worst neighborhoods of Philadelphia and New York and Houston and where have you, are quite willing to embrace Asian attitudes about effort if you give them a chance. Right? If you do it right, and you give them an environment that rewards that kind of attitude, and you show the, and the kids, it's clear to the kids that that kind of attitude has dividends, and that math, in fact, is something that can be mastered by working hard and not something you're born with or you're not. They'll change. So I think that there's a lot. I have another thing about flying and pilots that makes the same argument. So I think there's something profoundly optimistic in that. If I did not think that attitudes were malleable, I wouldn't have written this book, right? The book is premised very powerfully on the notion that all of this stuff I'm talking about, much of it, are things that we can do something about. But it requires us to be honest about culture, to talk about culture, which we don't want to talk about half the time, right? We want to pretend that we're all the same, and we're not. One more question. So this has to be a good one. So if you have any doubts whatsoever about your question, you should lower your hand right now. All right, in the corner.
By your last answer to that question, is it safe to say then that success runs in families or it runs in different groups?
It does. So, you know, the point of outliers is to locate the causes of success outside the individual. And so you're absolutely right. We would expect to see success as a product of specific generations, specific cultural groups, specific families. Anytime you have a group of people who have been given special access to opportunity, you will see patterns of success. So one of the chapters, for example, is about Jewish lawyers. Right? And it answers the question, tries to answer the question, why are all the most powerful lawyers in New York Jewish? And not only are they Jewish, they are overwhelmingly Jewish men born in the 1930s in the Bronx or Brooklyn to Eastern European immigrants who worked in the garment industry and who attended New York City public schools in the 40s, went to City College, and then New York University Law School or some equivalent. Right? Incredible how consistent the resume of the most powerful lawyers in New York is. Why is that? And I sort of walk through how every one of those factors represented a specific opportunity that was given to people from that cluster of characteristics. So, for example, the most important factor is it really matters if you're of that generation, if you're Jewish. And the reason is, when you graduated from law school in 1958, you couldn't get a job at the big downtown law firms in Wall Street. They wouldn't hire you, right? Because you were Jewish, right? They said, no way. In fact, they were very blunt about it, and you knew it. And I tell the story of their famous legal scholar named Alexander Bickel, who's one of the most famous constitutional scholars of 20th century, and he goes to Wall Street. I tell a story. I found an oral history of him. He died years ago. He describes going for his interview at some, it was at Mudge Rose, which is one of the kind of toniest of the waspiest blue-blooded law firms on Wall Street in those era. And he goes to his interview in the library with the paneling and, and there's this kind of big, pipe-smoking guy who's interviewing him. And understand that Bickel is, he is going to go on to be, he's like one of the greatest constitutional, later becomes one of the greatest constitutional scholars of the generation. There is no question about his credentials to be a great lawyer. And he interviews, and the guy at the end of the interview says, you're all very fine, and I'm sure you're a good person, but I hope you understand that we have no room at this firm for someone of your antecedents. Right? Meaning he was from Brooklyn. His parents are Romanian Jews. He had an accent, right? Hair was the wrong color. Eyes were not blue. So that happened. So what happened to those guys who couldn't get jobs at the firms? Well, they went and they founded their own firms. They had to, right? And what happened at those? What kind of law did they practice at those firms? Well, they had these little firms, and they didn't have any. They weren't had none of the contacts everyone else did. They were forced to do the kind of law that the big law firms didn't want to do. What kind of law did the big WASPy law firms not want to do in the 1950s and 1960s? Three kinds. Litigation, bankruptcy, takeover, right? What happened 20 years later? Litigation, bankruptcy, and takeover became the three most lucrative forms of law in the country, right? And what were these little law firms full of guys who couldn't get jobs suddenly in a position of doing? Dominating the profession, because they knew what no one else knew. They were experts in these three areas of an incredible stroke of good fortune in the end. Now, that does not justify, the initial discrimination, which was a horrible act. But it was a symbol of what I'm talking about in this book, which is that sometimes, you know, through factors outside of our control or even understanding, opportunities are conferred on particular groups. And those kinds of special opportunities powerfully explain why those groups achieve as well as they do. And unless you're willing to look for those kinds of explanations, you don't know diddly about why people achieve or not. Right? You're left with a completely inadequate explanation. So it's an important factor. Thanks very much.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.